Welcome to Worlds Apart. Multipolarity has long been a trendy word among countries under US sanctions, but it didn't amount to much concrete apart from perhaps a somewhat helpless disdain of US hegemony. But over the last year and a half, as more and more nations were forced to find their own ways of dealing with Western pressure, multipolarity has started to take a more tangible form. What is it and where is it heading? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Ron Carlos, Venezuela's Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs for North America. Mr. Carlos, it's great to meet you. Great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Now, we are talking here on the sidelines of the Valdai Forum, which this year carries the title Fair Multipolarity, How to Ensure Security and Development for All. And I want to start by asking whether you believe it's even possible to ensure security and development for all and do it in a fair manner.
Well, I think it's something that we have to strive for sure. In Venezuela's own history, we are a revolution that inspired by Simón Bolívar, our liberator, who spoke about the equilibrium of the universe as a concept back in the 1800s. And he saw the tensions between the different poles that were rising, and that how we had to establish some sort of equilibrium and balance so that we can assure that everyone's interest was considered. And I think this is the point we're reaching now in this point in history, where we can no longer just sustain a worldview where only the interests of one country is accepted, but we have to make sure that we cater to the interests of different peoples, because that model of the single country is not enough to guarantee for the rest of humanity, a safe planet, safety from health or risk or disease. So there's a need for us to build something different. I think it is achievable, and I think it's something that we have to promote.
But even if we put that one country beyond the brackets for a moment, we all start from different bases, endowed with different resources, saddled with different challenges. How would you even assess the fairness of the framework if we are all moving at different paces and sometimes in different directions?
Well, I think that's where the art of diplomacy comes in, and the importance of dialogue, and how we have to build relations with countries, among countries that are relations built precisely on dialogue. We have to try to understand each other's, there's different cultures, there's a diversity. President Hugo Chavez spoke of pluripolarity, meaning that not only do we have to have different poles, but that we have to accept the diversity in each pole so that they can coexist. So I think it's important that we do that effort of dialoguing and trying to understand each other, see where our interests can meet. Mm-hmm. Because everybody obviously has different interests, everybody has different needs, but there's got to be a point where we can make them meet and work together for the best of all humanity.
Speaking about dialogue, last year at the Valdai plenary session, you asked the president of this country, Vladimir Putin, whether anything should be done to support this process of shaping multipolarity, and his answer was essentially no. You know, it's a natural development, and besides, the West is already doing everything necessary to bring multipolarity about. Do you agree with him that no specific measures are needed to protect or support this process?
Well, I think it's important that, like he mentioned, that this is something that is taking place now, and perhaps we will find out that along the way. For example, with the emergence of BRICS now as such a strong platform, that we may have to do some things to help it along the way and contribute to that building. I think it's important that we strengthen those processes, because that's where we can really see a new type of arrangement where people can different countries have different types of participation, and we can overcome systemic problems that we've had, for example, debt in countries in the South, in the global South, or even development, seeing another way of cooperation for development that doesn't impose a view of one country over another, but actually is a sum of necessities and opportunities. Mm-hmm.
Without getting into an argument with Vladimir Putin, I think sometimes it's very difficult to allow this let-be approach, not only because your opponents are piling economic sanctions onto you, but also because I think they are now overstepping their own values and their own laws to punish countries like ours. For example, I don't know if you've heard that, but the EU has recently introduced a measure that would allow its officials, customs officials, to strip Russian nationals of their personal belongings, like phones, like even toiletries. And that is coming from countries that are still believed to be the champions of personal freedoms and privacy. I wonder if we have come to a point when we have to be concerned about the unraveling of the West because of the Western sanctions.
Well, I think that's something that we're seeing a part of result of these sanctions and these policies is that it's a promotion of hate in a way. Not only happens to Russians, but in this case that you mentioned, but you've seen it happen, for example, in with Latin American migrants in the United States. Every time you have they place an aggression on the other, it's not only the law, it's not only the sanction itself, but it's also accompanied by a message of distancing themselves from the other and generating fear, hate. We have to distance ourselves from this policy. We have to stop these processes throughout the world. We're seeing this reemergence in Europe or also in Latin America of fascist tendencies that use hate in order to promote their policies. So it is part of this process. Mm-hmm.
They use hate to promote their policies, but they are also sort of very successful in projecting it out to other countries. They do not see that as hate. In fact, they seem to be very self-righteous. What could possibly bring it to their attention that they are doing the exact same things that they are accusing their enemies of?
The problem is that I think it will get to a point that these measures that they take and that they promote hurt them as well. Mm-hmm. And they're going to realize that their actions also have consequences. It already does in economic terms. I mean, we're seeing, for example, gas prices being probably the highest that they've been in the last few months in the United States, and partly is due because the way the sanctions impact oil markets throughout the world. If countries like Venezuela or Iran, for example, didn't have the sanctions placed on them, there could be a different...
Or Russia, for that fact.
Yes, there could be a very different consequences or the very different energy supply, and the effects on the U.S. people would be quite different. But also, you've seen in other issues, like even with migration itself, part of countries that are under economic distress because of sanctions, well, one of the results sometimes tends to be migration, and it's the United States who's also feeling effects.
So there is a feeding loop, whether they like it or not, but for the time being, they still prefer not to notice it.
Yes, and in a way, it is part of they're part of the problem. They believe that their actions don't have consequences, but they mm-hmm. do.
Mm-hmm. Now, the West is using not only direct sanctions against countries like Russia or Venezuela, but also secondary sanctions to penalize those who are willing to do business with the quote-unquote renegades. And that could be seen as a direct tool against multipolarity. If we understand multipolarity as a space where nations can relate to each other on their own terms. Do you think sooner or later multipolarity will require some sort of formal arrangement or protection against Western pressure?
Well, what we really need already exists, which is the principles enshrined in the UN Charter.
They're not practiced.
Well, but they're there. And you know, at one point in time, countries to become members of the UN, they signed the charter. They agreed to be part of it. And what we need to do is to rescue those ideals and those principles and stress the necessity of respecting them. The idea that the U.S., for example, can impose these unilateral measures is completely a violation of international law. So what we have to do is, we don't have to do the same. We have to defend and show that we respect international law, that we want a system where multipolarity can thrive, but, you know, countries can thrive because there's a minimum respect for each other's interests and well-being.
I don't know if you would agree with that, but what I find very interesting about our times is that, you know, those principles that have been enshrined in the UN Charter for decades, it now makes sort of sense to uphold them because it's in your own benefit. And we see some of the U.S. nominal allies like Saudi Arabia, like United Arab Emirates, becoming members of BRICS because they find it not only good on moral terms, it's in their practical developmental interest. Do you think there's something new about the way countries relate to those values enshrined in the UN Charter?
Well, we're definitely at a moment where we realize that relations have to be different. Because, again, the system that was prevailing, that was trying to be imposed on the rest of us, doesn't have the solutions to our problems. I think what countries are doing are realizing that they have to abide or follow those principles that we all share, and doesn't necessarily mean that we are going to subject ourselves to a country. It means that we have to build spaces where we can dialogue and contribute and cooperate, which is very important.
So we have to engage in authentic relationship rather than coercion. Now, speaking about Venezuela, your country has been under Western sanctions for a very long time, as has Iran, Cuba, some other nations, but it hasn't provoked these kind of rapid changes within the international economic and political system that we have observed recently. And I wonder if you see Western sanctions against Russia as a standout case, or whether it's simply the cumulative effect of all those years of sanctions against various countries that is influencing this or bringing about this rapid change within the international system.
Well, it also it has to do also with the size of countries and economies. Obviously, Russia is a much larger country, and the impact that these measures may have on the world because of how they affect Russia is different from how it may impact smaller countries. But the truth is that about 30% of the world is right now under some sort of unilateral coercive measure from the United States. And President Nicolas Maduro has been very open in denouncing these actions and how we have to find new solutions to end the dependency that we have, for example, on the dollar, or that we have on this capability that the United States has to
American impose. Financial institutions or American-led financial
yes.
institutions, which are told to be international.
That's why President Maduro said in the recent his message to the recent BRICS meeting in South Africa, of the importance that it was to find new alternatives, to find an architecture for a new financial model, to think about de-dollarization and see how we can have another organization of the world where we're not so depending on the United States. Mm-hmm.
Well, Mr. Carlos, we have to take a very short break. We are still dependent on our schedule, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Ron Carlos, Venezuela's Deputy Minister for Foreign Affairs for North America. Mr. Carlos, before the break, we mentioned sanctions that the United States maintained against your country for many years. And I know for a fact that Venezuelan and Iranian experience has been studied in Russia extensively to understand what to do and what perhaps not to do when dealing with these draconian measures against my country. I wonder if Venezuela has learned anything new or got any new ideas from the Russian experience.
Well, I think it's funny because when we, I remember one time speaking when the sanctions started under the Trump administration, I spoke to a Russian diplomat who I encountered with in Washington. And the first thing he told me was, well, you have to learn to live with sanctions. And in a way, it's true. You know, part of what we have seen from the experiences of Russia, but also of Iran, of Cuba, for many years, is that you know, the point of the sanction policy from the United States is to produce regime change and produce all these alterations of our reality, which are not in tune with the needs and the wants of the of our peoples. So we have to learn to. Even though we have these aggressions, how to make our own solutions and how to move forward. The experience from Russia now, of course, is also interesting for us, as all the other ones. And I think what we have learned is that nobody's going to give us anything for free. We have to, well, whatever we're going to do for our future and however we're going to develop our country, we have to do it by defending it ourselves, by organizing our peoples. Mm-hmm. So I think that is the best lesson that we can learn overall.
It's interesting you say that because, you know, a substantial part of those sanctions were brought about after the elections of 2018. And next year, you're facing another presidential vote. Do you expect any American interference, or do you think the Americans would be too preoccupied with their own domestic political strife?
Well, I think if we look at history, you know, this year will be the 200th anniversary of the Monroe Doctrine, which is
you think they're going to celebrate? Well, by interference.
The thing is, what we've seen is this constant intervention in the continent, you know, in different shapes or forms, from coups to sanctions to invasions, everything. But so the tendency is that there will always try to find a way to, you know, engage in our processes and alter it in their favor. I think the Venezuelan people know what their reality are. You know, I think we have faced all these aggressions, all these problems, and that we have had steady leadership under President Maduro that has led the country out of that, that aggression. We have been able to grow in the last year, that, you know, which is something that nobody was able to predict, you know, just a couple of years earlier, because they thought that everything would collapse. And we have shown that, you know, we are capable of achieving a different outcome. So I think the Venezuelan people know that you know, they have to keep advancing in their democratic process, in the deepening our revolutionary process. And I think that will be the outcome, regardless of whatever intervention takes place. Venezuela is a democracy, and you know, we will have elections, and different forces would measure themselves. But I think the Venezuelan people know where the horizon is.
Speaking about different forces, Juan Guaido, whom the West at that time recognized as the interim president of Venezuela, is barely seen or mentioned anymore. How do you assess his political fortunes?
Well, I think it was he left the country. He's not even a political figure of any importance right now in Venezuela. And I think many countries now realize that it was, you know, ridiculous to have supported that adventure of trying to recognize a government that didn't exist, that, you know, not only didn't have any legal basis, but also didn't have any popular support. I mean, nobody that was portrayed as a leader could simply leave the country and there would be no effects whatsoever. You could see how it is. Venezuela's overcome that that chapter. I think we're looking forward. We're looking ahead. And President Maduro has shown us a way towards growth, towards the improvement of services for the Venezuelan people. I think that's the path we're on, and that's the important path.
As you said, you're looking forward, but I also want to ask you to look sideways a little bit, because I'm interested in your opinion about the American elections, which are also coming up next year. And I think what's different, and we've talked about that a little bit already, is that the situation for the Americans themselves is different. They have never been so polarized as they are right now. And I wonder if you think that the outcome of the next year vote will have any bearing on how the multipolarity is shaping, or how the events on your continent are shaping out.
Well, I think, first of all, I want to say, we are respectful of the sovereignty of the people of the United States. So whatever decision they make, of course, we respect, and that's what we want them to do in our
but,
case.
But let's admit, the choice is quite unprecedented, and it's very, I mean, perhaps not very inspiring even for the Americans themselves, judging from the polls.
Well, there's many problems in U.S. society now that they're facing, because their model is, again, it's not able to fulfill the expectations of people. You have seen growth in homelessness. You have seen growth in poverty. So there's a lot of affectations on the people of the United States. So then they need to find a way to vote for, solving their own problems and not trying to police the world or trying to engage in our elections. I hope that whatever comes as a result is a renewed opportunity to engage with the United States diplomatically and on equal terms. I mean, maybe a high bar to set, but I think it is important that we remember we've always been willing to engage with the United States diplomatically, as long as it's a relationship of mutual respect. When you don't have mutual respect, then all these other deformations comes about. So my hopes, at least, are that whatever outcome it is, it's something that can lead to a respectful relationship.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of those issues polarizing U.S. domestic politics is immigration, and it's no secret that Venezuelan migration to the United States is linked perhaps directly to the sanctions policy. And I think this is one of the very, very few ways that the Americans can directly experience the consequences of their actions. But I wonder if migration is still big enough of a challenge to influence the American approach, either to sanctions or to your own country, for their own sake.
Well, the problem is what we've seen in throughout history in U.S. politics is that sometimes whenever these election moments come, and there's always a foreign adversary of some sort, either is it could be one day China, one day Russia, or any other country, or it could be in the shape of migrants from anywhere in Latin America. In this case, because of the narrative, they have a negative narrative against Venezuela. They're focusing on Venezuelan migrants, but Venezuela is not even the main source of migrants in the United States right now. In any case, a lot of that migration historically in our region has had to do with the intervention of the United States. Now it's sanctions, but before, the coups, the sabotage to democratic governments that just didn't align to their purposes, that led for people to seek solutions and to seek them north, because at the end of the day, you affect the economies in a way that people, they want to look for their other economic possibilities. So it's a moment where there must be a lot of reflection on the side of the people of the U.S. to see where the real problems are, where they should focus their energies. It's not necessarily foreign threats. It's the way it's functioning inside that they need to deal with.
I don't know if you would agree with that, but I think it is this perception of invincibility that for decades allowed the American political class to rule with impunity and to sort of believe that their actions don't have consequences. And if you look closely, the whole concept of American exceptionalism is ultimately rooted in this idea that they are somehow above and beyond retribution. My question to you is, what do you think may persuade not the American people, but the American elites that their humans like anyone else, and therefore they should be constrained, self-constrained, by some notion of common responsibility, or at least responsibility before their own people.
I think their model, the current model, has shown it's not sustainable. I think economically it's not going to be sustainable in the long run. The challenges they're facing within the country, the growth of poverty, the growth of drug use, which has now become one of the main or the primary cause of death in youth in the United States, show that there's something essentially wrong with the system, that there and that exceptionalism is not going to be the answer. I think, and also, you know, you mentioned the elites, but the fact that the people are realizing this, I think, is important. Mm-hmm. Because, there is... You can even say there's even a massive anti-imperialist movement that we don't see in the media, but that it does live in the United States and doesn't want its country to and its government to do these actions. And I think that's growing every day. And, you know, sometime it's going to reach those decision makers. There's got to be new generations of lawmakers and to come into U.S. politics that focus on real people's problems. That has to happen.
You come from a country with a strong revolutionary tradition, but I think there comes a point for any country when revolution has to give way to diligent work. I mean, revolutionary slogans are not enough. You actually need to provide for your people, and it's a very hard and oftentimes underappreciated work of governance. I sometimes wonder if the Americans are stuck in this revolutionary phase of thinking of themselves as sort of the shining city on the hill without even caring of, you know, working the fields or, you know, the roads inside that hill.
Well, I think there has to be a change of that exceptionalist mentality. But I think, again, the problems that they're going to encounter, they're encountering right now in the streets, is what's going to shock
them. How do you think that change will come? Because the American system as it exists today does not allow for, in my view at least, for a free and comprehensive expression of political will, because a choice between Biden and Trump is, with all due respect to the Americans, is a very poor and limited choice.
Well, there's other movements that I think are important within, local. There's got to be a gradual empowerment of people, and it's already started in local levels. You see a different class of politicians in city councils, in other places that are contesting some of these age-old policies that come from exceptionalism. It's a process, and maybe we're not going to see it next year or maybe in 10, 20 years. It's sometimes these changes take a long time. But you can see that there's something brewing and that it has to come out because it's not sustainable. The way they're doing it is not sustainable.
Well, on this note, Mr. Carlos, we have to leave it there, but thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.